broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to The Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
And a very good morning to all of our listeners, and welcome back, guys, to the first podcast of 2019.
Good to be back.
Thanks, happy Steph. New Year.
Yeah, did you guys welcome. All have a safe and happy Christmas?
Sure did.
Yeah. Well, it's still alive, so it must have been safe.
And what did everyone get up to? Were you away for the holidays?
Yeah, beach time.
Yep. Lots of beach time.
Yep.
Lots of family time.
Yeah, Louis, I heard you went fishing.
A little bit of fishing. That was nice. We had Christmas at the grandparents' place. My daughter got to play with grandparents and cousins and other family members, and we got to relax for a week and a half.
Yep.
And offload our parental duties to everyone else.
Beautiful.
Until she causes a fuss, and then it's back on us.
And I heard lots of chocolate for breakfast as well.
Oh, yeah. It's the worst.
The pacifier. The new pacifier.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Joel, you've got a nice tan there, looking relaxed.
Oh, yeah. I've had a nice time sipping Mai Tais and watching hula.
Mai Tais.
Watching the hula dance over in Hawaii. So that was lovely.
Ah, beautiful.
All right, well, kicking off this year, Joel, we might actually throw across to you just to give us a bit of an update on what's been happening over the last 3 to 4 weeks.
Well, what hasn't been happening?
It has not been a quiet time for you, Joel, has it?
No, it hasn't been. No,
it's been a working holiday.
There's been a fair bit going on over the last, well, particularly the last week of leading up to Christmas time and then leading into Christmas. We have had an extraordinary amount of volatility. At one stage, the S&P 500, the US stock market, was down 20% from its peak in September, at the end of September, early October. The Russell 2000 was down around about 25%, and the NASDAQ, sorry, the Russell 2000 was down about 27.5%, and the NASDAQ was down about 25%. Before we have seen this last 3 week rally that has pretty much got back everything that was lost, and then a little bit more since Jerome Powell came out and made his speech leading into Christmas time about interest rates and the direction of interest rates for 2019.
Was that the speech where he just couldn't shut up?
That was the speech where we just wish he had have just sat down, raised interest rates, sat down and gone on holidays for about 2 or 3 weeks.
He needed a Mai Tai.
Yeah. I mean, look, interestingly enough, I mean, there's so many headline issues out there at this point in time, but really none of them are moving markets quite like the Federal Reserve is moving markets. I mean, you've got the US and China still, you know, bickering about their trade issues. You've got Trump is shutting down the government because he wants his money for his wall. Yep. You got Brexit going on.
Debacle.
And no one seems to give a rat's ass about those three things. It's really about whether or not, you know, if Jerome Powell wants to raise interest rates by 2 times, 1 times, or no times at all.
The psychology of people.
So it's been amazing. I think Jerome Powell's learned a little bit of a lesson around the power of his speech and how powerful he actually is as an individual and the committee. Mm. He was certainly in early January, he was forced to, only a couple of weeks after the comments that he made, forced to retract or remove himself away from perhaps that harder, hawkish position to become a little bit more dovish. And the market took that as a major signal for that the Fed is actually listening. Mm. And the market has been rallying strongly. In fact, on the day that he made the speech, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose by around about 3.8, 3.9% on the day. And it actually, so there's a measure of how powerful that buying move. The NASDAQ was up around about 4.5%, 4.6%
in one day.
And there's a measure on the, on how powerful that buying volume was on that particular day and how big the upthrust in price was, what they call the advanced decline line. And basically it measures the number of advancing issues, stock issues versus declining stock issues. And on the day that he released that presentation, the measure on the advanced decline line was at a measure of 1.9, which means that, you know, for every declining issue, there was 1.9.
So nearly 2 to 1.
Basically, yeah, 2
nearly
to 1.
Double. Yeah. And that growth in one day, can you put that in perspective? Like,
well, historically, when we have seen a measure of 1.9 or greater, it's only happened 25 times in the last 70 years. And 24 of the 25 times that it's occurred, the stock market was higher 12 months later for an average gain of 20%.
In that period.
Ooh. after that upward movement. So you've already seen a large movement prior to that. Then the day of, 3.8%. And then from the close of that day, you've got another 20% on average 12 months later from the close of that closing price. And 24 of the last 25 times that it's happened, it's been positive 12 months later. So
we shouldn't be worried, John.
Well, who knows what happens going forward, but I have been very consistent, even in the face of all of this treacherous market volatility, that the underlying macroeconomic fundamentals look much, much better than what the market is perhaps indicating is going to be coming down the pipeline over the next 12 months. And look, I think what it does say, though, is that we are in a different market environment today. The drivers of share price movements are very different to what they were 10 years ago and 20 years ago. You have high-frequency trading high-frequency trading is all about basically trying to make small little price gains and price movements with very, fast millisecond, trades, trying to capture
any
sort of
fraction of a cent, and let's do it a million times.
Let's try and do it a million times. Now, when volatility spikes, though, those types of algorithms, they can't function in a very fast moving volatile environment, because big price moves could wipe out their profitability when they're relying on such a small margin of error. So what they do is they just pull liquidity from the market and they stop trading altogether. All of a sudden, you've got a vacuum of demand and a vacuum of transactions. Then any sort of selling that comes into the market thereafter, which comes from passive investors, ETFs, algorithms that are driving those ETF transactions, and trend following algorithms that are all automated, all of a sudden volume comes out of the market. Selling pressure doesn't need much to really see the market fall, because you haven't got a lot of volume that's now in the market. And we're now more susceptible these days to these types of wild price swings because of this automation that is going on. About 90% of all transactions today in the stock market are driven by non-traditional investors.
90%.
90%.
And is that American and Australian stock markets, or global?
Well, that's the US.
US.
That's
yeah.
the US. 90% of all volume that goes through the US stock market today is non-traditional investors like us, mum and dad buyers, or fund managers that are making decisions and on fundamentals and then going in there and accumulating stock or selling stock. It's 90% of the volume on the New York Stock Exchange is driven by algorithm electronic trading programs that aren't.
So how do you change your strategy, Joel, when you're looking at client portfolios at the moment? What are you doing as far as the direction you're taking with the market volatility and what's going on?
Okay, well, I think what you've got to understand is that still in the medium to long term, fundamentals will always win out. If corporate profits are rising, valuations of companies will have to increase. And the algorithms over time will recognize that, and so will the fund managers. And the fund managers will start buying those good quality companies that the algorithms then see the trends forming, that then pile into that again. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing is that in the short term, the volatility can really stretch beyond what most people think is fair and reasonable and what really should be fair and reasonable. I mean, there's no reason in an environment where US corporate profits at the end of the third quarter that were up 26% over the last 12 months should then see a stock market decline of 25% in the next 3 months after that. I mean, that just makes absolutely no sense at all.
Crazy.
Yep. Okay, so
what about the Australian stock market?
Well, the Australian stock market still takes its lead from the US. I mean, the US is the elephant in the room. Australian corporate profits are still doing pretty well as well. I mean, we're not growing at the pace that the US is, because there's a whole range of tax cuts and the US economy is doing a lot better than the Australian economy in terms of where it is in the cycle at the moment. But Australian companies are still growing profits as well. So, this sell-off leading into Christmas time and just into Christmas was a complete overreaction and a complete overshoot. And we've just seen that with the fact that all the Fed has to do is say, okay, we're going to be a little bit more market data dependent. And all of a sudden, you've now seen pretty much a 12% increase in the last 2.5 weeks since then.
So, Joel, I'm going to come to the price action, looking at the US markets, but also the Australian market. The US markets had their most recent major high in September, the end of September. In Australia, it was the end of August.
Yep.
They had a decline in value in September. In our podcast, you said you weren't nervous. Had further declines in October. You said you still weren't nervous. Further declines in November. You said you were still not nervous, but you were taking positions, you know, in case of the worst.
It's called resilience, isn't it?
And then further declines in December, with a peak decline on the 24th of December, Merry Christmas, to what is now a low of the market. But since December 24, just looking at the numbers as to as the close as currently, the Dow Jones is up since December 24, 13.5%. NASDAQ is up 11.5%. The All Ordinaries Index is up by 7.5%. But that's only about half of the decline that's now been made up since September or August. So what do you see from now?
Okay, well, yeah, look, it was a complete pants shitting just prior to Christmas. But look, the reality is we didn't capitulate. We never sold. We did put on some hedges in some instances, and we took those hedges off pretty quickly when we saw the reversal day that took place just after Christmas time.
So there was actually a day where you saw the price action give a common signal of a reversal in trend.
Yes, it was the day. In fact, it was a big reversal day that took place on the 26th of December. So we had the capitulation that came in on the prior to Christmas, 24th.
Yep.
Christmas Day was off. And then the very next day, Boxing Day in the US, which they don't celebrate, but was a major up day.
So a trading day in the US, 26th of December.
S&P 500 completely reversed the declines, was up 4.9% for the day. And I've seen it many times before. I saw it in October of 2008 when I was watching the screens and the market was down about 4%. And then all of a sudden we saw a major reversal in commodity stocks. And we saw a 4% decline intraday turn up to about a 4% increase in one day. When you see that type of buying, that type of reversal and price action, it's a very strong sign that a low is in. Whether it's the low or not, you don't know at that point in time, but we were oversold on so many measures at extremes that we hadn't seen since 2008, March 2008, October 2008, March 2009. You know, we hadn't seen this level of oversold conditions in the last 10 years. And when you see a major reversal day like that, followed by a follow-through day that took place on the 8th of January, you know, that's certainly a key indication that you got a short-term uptrend that's going to be in place. We started putting on some positions that we took off just prior to as we broke through some support levels just prior to Christmas, and we're pretty much back to full investment at this point in time. Now, I still expect that volatility is going to be around, and usually what happens is you don't get one low without a test of that low. So there is, while we still feel that, you know, over the next 6-12 months or so, we're going to be getting back up to those highs and possibly even maybe, you know, pushing above them over time, we're still going to see volatility. And whether or not this current rally continues to rise and then we get a pullback, or we get a bit of a pullback here and then we rise from here, who knows? But all things being equal, you would expect that the low.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund?
That's right. That's right.
But all things being equal, you would now expect that the low is that were once thought
the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high performance stocks and real estate.
Follow back up.
can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Welcome back, guys. We're now going to throw over to Brett, who's just going to give us an update on the residential property market.
Sure. Well, any Game of Thrones fans out there would know that winter is coming. And I believe it's the last series of Game of Thrones that'll be aired this year, which really means winter is here.
Right.
And I believe that's really the case with the residential property market in Australia. No doubt last year there was a pullback and all the data shows that there was a drop in, you know, median house prices. And the early market commentary that's starting to come out for the first time in 2019 is that we're probably in for more of the same this year. Okay. And that's fine. You know, obviously no one wants that, but like anything that, you know, we say winter is coming, well, after winter, there's going to be spring and then there'll be summer and the seasons roll on. So property does have a cycle. And, you know, even though there may be further drops this year, long term, it will still continue to recover and prices will grow again. But what the question I have then is, so what do you do then? If we're in winter, what do you do? Well, you know, Australia typically has a mild winter compared to a lot of the rest of the world. But in the rest of the world, I know the majority of people in those states, when winter hits, they prepare for summer. So a lot of the times what we should be doing now in regards to properties, we should be starting to look at it and go, well, not so much the, you know, what the price is, but what are my circumstances and what are my goals and what am I going to do within this market? Okay, so before I go on to what your options could be and how you may need to look at that, I'll just mention two of the big doomsayer market commentaries that's come out. So one is from Fitch Ratings, who believe that Australia's housing price drop is expected to be the worst in the world.
Yay.
For 2019.
And surely they're going to put a figure on that.
Yeah, they always do. Yeah. So they believe house prices will fall by another 5% this year.
Okay.
Okay. And values won't recover until 2020. Okay, so maybe 2020 is when summer comes again.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you're a property investor, and as we've always advocated, if you're investing in property, it's a long-term strategy.
Yeah. Mm.
So even if you bought last year and prices have dropped, you're holding it for 10 or more years. If summer comes again in 2020, maybe there's a few summers before you sell, we would anticipate that your property is worth well more by the time you sell than what you bought it for.
Yeah.
So as long as you've got that outlook, you know, you can absorb the seasons.
And now's the time to start preparing for which properties you want to start acquiring.
Correct.
Yeah, and we've had a really good run with the price of property going
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. Yeah, it grew at rates that weren't sustainable.
Yeah,
so
it's leveling out, really.
It has to, because you couldn't keep growing at that rate, and especially with the affordability, you know, the gap between wages and property prices. And thankfully, low interest rates have kept that in check, but, you know, all these things have an impact. So I wanted to pose the question, given winter is you know, pretty much here for the property market, what does that mean and what decisions do you make? And I've sort of thought I'd break it down, because that decision can really only come down to your circumstances and your goals. You know, yes, the market is what the market is and you can't influence that really. So the only thing you can do is make decisions about it relevant to your own status. Mm. And I thought, okay, so when it comes to residential property, you've really got a few different categories of buyers. You've got your current homeowner that may be thinking, okay, do I want to buy or sell at the moment? And you've got your current property investor that may be holding and thinking about whether they should buy or sell. And then people that aren't in the market that are thinking of entering it. So that's sort of the first part of the profile of a person that may be looking at the property market. The other thing is, well, what's your time to retirement? That could have a severe impact too, because, you know, depending on what your retirement plans are, when you need to realize it, you know, that would have an impact on whether you're thinking to buy or sell in the near term. The other part of it, if you are a current property owner, is that property giving you what you need?
Yeah.
So that could be two things. If you're a current homeowner and you're living in it, is it right for your lifestyle? Is it big enough for your family? Is it too big for your family? Is it in a location that suits what you're wanting to do? Are you happy there? Okay. If you're an investor, is it giving you the performance you need? Is it renting well? Is it delivering the performance from a yield perspective? Is the prospects of growth right for that type of property in that neighborhood? Because all of these things are going to have an impact on the decision you will make next.
Mm.
So those decisions are more than likely going to be independent of the market.
Yep.
Because you'll be dictated by what your property is doing and what your needs are. So with that in mind, it's really hard to give a recommendation or a blanket rule. So I just thought...
Isn't it, Brett?
Yeah, always the case. I tried to come up with a rule of thumb, but I just couldn't think of one.
But Brett, do you think that the media is actually starting to affect... I mean, it always has a flow-on effect, but when I look at that, I think to myself, oh, great time for me to get in because I haven't purchased a property yet. But do other people think, well, I better not sell, so I'm going to hold on to my property and I'm not going to do anything, and they sort of go deer in headlights?
Well, I think of it this way. If you're thinking to sell, if you're a homeowner and you're looking to sell, well, you're selling for reasons. Yes, there's a financial impact, but you're obviously selling your home for reasons of lifestyle or something that's impacting your life.
Yep.
So if you're selling when the market's potentially lower than it was 12 or 18 months ago and you're thinking, oh, I won't get as much, but chances are if you're selling, you're then buying again, so you're buying at a lower rate.
Yeah.
So it should have a negative impact on your overall position when you think selling lower but buying lower, overall I'm moving for roughly the same impact.
Mm.
If you're an investor, well, yeah, if you're an investor and you're thinking, well, maybe now is the time to sell, well, why are you selling? If it's a poor performing asset and it's never going to work for you, well, fair enough. Realize maybe it is time to sell out and put your funds towards a better asset. But if it's a quality asset and you don't have a plan for retirement soon, or you don't need the funds, why would you even consider selling while the market's, you know, in wintertime, as we say?
If you have a poor performing asset and you're wondering when is a good time to sell it, I don't think there's any good or bad time to sell it.
You sell it when you realize.
Except for now.
Mm. Yeah.
Sell if it's poor performing, then you should count your losses and sell it straight away, I think.
Yep, agreed. As soon as you realize it's not the right property, that's when you make the decision to sell.
Yep. Mm. Yep. Brett, can I ask... and Steph as well, with your question about the media, would you think of there being two different types of people in that there are the followers and then there are the people who are ahead of the curve? So there are those who are maybe a bit more conservative and reactive, and then there are those who are trying to get ahead and they are a bit more aggressive. My thought at the moment is, what I'm hearing is, it's not a great time to sell property at the moment because it is a soft market. And in property, you've got this market, if you're either on the selling side or you're on the buying side.
Mm.
And if it's a bad time for sellers, well then, doesn't that mean it's a good time for buyers?
Typically. That's the equation.
Yeah. Yep. But Brett, you and I have been working on some property transactions just leading into Christmas time. And one of the biggest frustrations is the quality, good quality properties not coming to market.
Yeah. Yep.
Right.
Yeah. You know, those people who aren't in a position where they have to sell and they know that they're holding on to good property, they're just, even if they were thinking of selling, they're not putting it to market right now because they don't have to. And so the availability of good quality property is not great out there.
Okay. And that's a general consensus with friends that I've spoken to as well. They're like, oh, I was thinking about selling, but, you know, now the property market's declined. I think I'll hold on to it for a while and see if it rebounds. And you think, oh, okay, well, you know, you say people, some are ahead of the curve. Yes, they are. But there's a lot of people that do get affected by what is in the media, whether it's wrong or right.
Yep.
People do follow and, you know, tend to make their decisions based on what they're reading.
Yep.
So it's human nature.
Okay.
And one of the interesting things is you're not seeing distressed sellers at this point in time. So the opportunity there's not like there's a plethora of, you know, awesome properties that are sitting on the market ready to be sold that we can snap up at this point in time, which leads me to believe that this is just an ordinary garden variety correction rather than a crash.
Just a winter time that'll pass and the spring and summer will come.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you would see in a normal, you know, crash type environment, you see great quality properties coming onto the market that you can pick up at discounts, but it's just not happening.
Right. And Steph, I'll just say another thing related to what you're talking about in regards to the media. So there was an article just this week. The former head of the REIV is now the head of real estate at CoreLogic. And he was quoted in an article just this week saying that it's the consumer confidence that is the only thing lacking from the market starting to rise again. He says the fundamentals are all there. Yep. You know, the economy's fine. He says it's just obviously the consumer sentiments and the confidence in the market's probably not there from a lot of the buyers. And a lot of that's on the back of obviously the Royal Commission and the availability of funds. So if lending eases a little bit, and you know, people that are looking to invest or buy can get access to higher levels of debt, we'll probably see a turnaround sooner rather than later on that. But there's no real timeline on that at this stage. And one other part of it is speaking with an architect recently that does a lot of work for a very wealthy family, and his advised that the family's had money in property for generations. And the father of the family, who's been through a number of property cycles, has been talking with his son, and they're talking about whether they should be buying property. They do developments, so they're looking at properties to acquire for future development. And he's given his son the instruction that you buy now. Well, in other words, he's seeing that the buying time, cycle is now. So I guess, you know, when prices are, well, if you think now, if you were thinking the property market was good 12 months ago or 18 months ago and you were wanting to get in, well, it's 10 to 20% lower now. So why isn't that a good time to buy?
Yeah. As you said, though, just making sure that what you're buying is quality. I'm obviously always sure that he'd case. Be... He'd be sort of equipped to pick the best ones, but
and no shortage of money to be able to
yeah,
do
that's
so.
Right.
And I guess when you've got deep pockets, you can pick and choose when the time's right, and you've got the ability to get the terms right.
Yeah.
One last thing I'll say before we move on to another topic. Another article said, okay, with the likely decline in pricing, then what are the areas to look at? And this is not something that I'm saying I've researched. I just thought I'd put it out there that some experts have revealed the in-demand areas with affordable median house prices. So most of the time, first-time property investor, or even a regular property investor, they're not buying your $1-3 million properties. They're buying in that sort of $400,000 to maybe $800,000 price bracket. So these experts believe that certain areas of Tasmania and Victoria are showing the best value.
Right.
So I don't know the Tasmanian market well enough, but I've had a look at the suburbs they're recommending for Victoria, and most of them are regional, the likes of mainly Ballarat and suburbs of Geelong.
Yeah, right.
Which where we believe are showing good signs too.
Are you concerned about your finances?
We're not saying this is right or wrong,
maybe
but
you're not sure
certainly
if
the
you'll
price
have enough
points
money
make
to
sense
retire
where you
on.
Can still buy
or maybe
quality houses for between
$400,000 or even
$500,000.
A significant promotion or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis.
Oh, well, if you're investing, it's your tenants that have to get themselves to work.
United Global Capital's advisors are
experts
in the areas of strategic financial planning,
price points and where they believe growth.
Superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds.
Well, good advice.
Risk
we'll
management,
just throw to
estate
break, and we'll
planning,
be back after this
and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, welcome back, guys. So we're now going to move on to Louis, who's just going to speak to us about the Productivity Commission's report into superannuation.
The quiet news often comes out over Christmas and New Year, but I did pick up on one thing, which was a couple of notes about the Productivity Commission's report into the superannuation sector. Some of this is old and repeated news because they did release an interim report halfway through last year, but they've now finalised that report. And I wanted to bring up a couple of things which the Productivity Commission has suggested for the superannuation system moving forward. Now, what the Productivity Commission is trying to do is have the Australian economy be more productive and eliminate waste from the economy. So as far as superannuation goes, What they're trying to do is prevent individuals from losing their retirement savings. They're trying to help the overall population to have high retirement savings. And they're seeing the issues as poor performing super funds and super funds with excessive fees and the problem of duplicated accounts having duplicate fees. And what they see as a problem in insurance when there is high costs of insurance or duplicated insurance that people don't need.
So how does that come about, the duplicated accounts or duplicated insurance?
Well, when you change employer, your new employer may set up a second superannuation account for you if you don't nominate your first superannuation account for contributions.
Right.
And there are still some employers that mandate through some kind of enterprise agreement that you use their superannuation, their nominated super fund.
Right. So duplicate accounts means I've got two self-managed, but two super funds in existence.
That's right, yeah. Yep. Two super funds in existence. Some people have three, four, five super funds in
existence.
I've
been a victim of that before and had to roll them all over. So.
There you
go. And that's hard work.
Yep, that's right, that's right. So they have made it easier now through the better linkage and communication system between super funds, so that helps. But what they have said in their recent report is two ideas. The first idea is to have an official shortlist of the top 10 performing super funds in Australia. And this shortlist would be updated once every 4 years. What impact do you guys think that that would have on people making choices on their super funds?
Well, I'd just go for the top performing ones, and that would really cut out a lot of the other ones. And also, you know, does that really sort of cannibalise the market?
Well, I think before you even consider that is, will the everyday Australian know about this list and will they be viewing it? Assuming they are, I would assume that they'll just pick something from the top two or three according to what they've heard of or something along those lines.
Yep. I see an issue with that in that if they're only talking about superannuation funds, usually those superannuation funds are talking about balanced or balanced growth type portfolios.
I would imagine it would be their My Super options, which is exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, and so there's the I see that this could be quite easy for people who aren't all that sophisticated to think that these are the best performing funds when in actual fact they're not. They're not the best performing investment opportunities that you can find out there. It's just that in a category of diversified My Super funds, they're the best performing and you could still be leaving a lot of return on the table.
Interesting.
Well, if you think about it, most balanced growth funds sort of average around about 8.5%, but the stock market does about 9.6% on average. And if you're an accumulator thinking that that's the best fund, well, you could actually be leaving some return on the table just by...
Well, that data alone tells you that you're losing a percent to what you could be.
Yep. And if you lose a percent over 30 years,
compounding,
that adds up to a hell of a lot of retirement savings.
Yeah. Will the UGC Platinum Alpha strategy be in there somewhere listed?
Number one, isn't it? Okay.
Well, it's not quite a My Super product, but yeah.
No, how do we get not. There?
Yep. And I would tend to agree that it's only comparing and rating based on someone else's criteria.
Yeah.
So whoever's coming up with that shortlist, well, what's the criteria they're using? And just because it's a super fund that suits a certain criteria, what if you're a person who is younger than that? Or what if you're a person who is closer to retirement than that? So what is actually appropriate for the individual?
And who are they saying will generate this list?
Some kind of panel.
Panel. Okay, so they'll be independent, supposedly?
Supposedly independent, yes. But I don't know who would be on that panel.
Do they say what the measures are actually going to be? What are they looking at? Like, I mean, what aspects of
them? Oh, that's some of the concerns that have been brought up with some of the political parties is, well, who's going to decide it and what are the criteria? Because this year's best performing super fund is not necessarily next year's best performing super fund. What do you think the super funds will do if there is a list of the top 10 and they're either on it or not on it?
Well, you'd be fighting to meet the criteria every year, wouldn't you? I mean, I'd be saying I want to get on that list. So what am I going to do in that focus area to bring my super fund up?
If I'm one of those funds with potential, I'm figuring out how do I get on there, because that's my my best marketing strategy used to be there.
That's right.
Yep.
And also, I mean, that's just, it could be quite biased towards, you know, giving those particular funds, you know, a lot of media coverage and... you know, it could be very damaging for the rest of the industry.
So I guess that's the intention of the Productivity Commission, is to give the other super funds a really strong incentive to get on that list and be better in general, but only for those people who are only making a choice on their default super.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's the employer who is choosing a default super fund for their employees. So it's really still talking about those people that are not really all that engaged with their super. So the
but
problem,
but there's still a lot.
Which is a lot. Which, as far as the Productivity Commission goes, is their intention to try and deal with the masses and work out a policy that works for the masses. What is the best rule of thumb that they can apply? And as you know, I hate rules of thumbs when it comes to your personal finance. You should be making choices based on your individual circumstances. And I'll come back to those three problems that that they're trying to solve: the problem of poor performance, the problem of fees being higher than they should, and the problem of insurance fees, whether they're appropriate or not. You should be making decisions on those three things and tailoring each of those things for your personal circumstances, for your retirement objectives and insurance needs, and your level of comfort with certain investments. So I think if you are paying attention to this, then you're missing the point. Choosing your super shouldn't be one decision. It should be at least three decisions. What's the investment performance and strategy that I want? What is the fees that I'm happy to pay for that strategy? And what is my insurance position? How much protection should I have? And how much should I be paying for it? And those are three decisions, which unfortunately is a lot more complicated than looking at a list of the top 10 and saying, oh, I'm just going to pick the top one. So I think if you're just picking off a list or looking at a TV ad and choosing a super fund based on that or their billboard, then I think you're missing out.
Well, let's hope that it doesn't go the same way as the property market with the media and sort of just being influenced by what you're reading, because that would be really disturbing. Interesting advice, something we'll watch this space on. All right. So thanks for that advice, Louis. That's really great and something we should watch. We'll now kick over to You Can't Be Serious. Who's got one for this week?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious.
Well, we better lead off by saying the great man is actually in town at the moment. So the voice behind this segment is actually here as one of the lead commentators on the Australian Open at the moment. And I did see something on some of the tennis footage where they had like the top five greatest tennis tantrums of all time. And pleased to say that he still holds number one position with that particular outbreak. So we're on the right. We've backed the winner there.
We've chosen well.
Excellent. He probably holds position number 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah,
I think they might have said,
okay, we've got to make it five different people. Keep the variety there. Otherwise, it might have just been the John McEnroe top five.
That's right. But,
That particular one did come in at number one. So I guess, look, I've got a couple, but the first one is still on the tennis stream. And I have to say to both Bernard Tomic and Nick Kyrgios, if you follow them,
Give yourself an uppercut.
The attack on Leighton Hewitt and the way they go about their own, you know, dealings on the tennis court. And
maybe go and win a few games before you actually start dissing somebody who's won two majors
and being a number one in the world. He's well respected around Australia and has always, you know, put everything he can out there.
Give yourself an uppercut.
Yeah. So that's the one I wanted to say.
I've got one which happened over the Christmas break where passers by a suburban house in Western Australia heard a man screaming, "Why don't you die?" And the sounds of a child crying. So of course they called the police to find that the man was extremely scared of spiders and had basically turned his house upside down trying to kill a spider that was on the loose.
Western Australia, this didn't happen over the Christmas period, when you were there.
Well, when I called Triple O, I was very concerned. No, it wasn't me.
That's hilarious. I would do the same thing. Any more?
I do have another one. How's this for a headline? Man denies turning home into restaurant despite a sign above his door.
You cannot be serious!
Not just any sign, but it was a large illuminated sign for his restaurant, which also had flyers and a website promoting people to come to his address to get their sushi.
Yeah. Oh, right. Maybe he's just having a big Christmas feast.
Yeah, a bit of household home cooking, eh?
No,
yeah.
Officer, there's no restaurant here. Would you like a table?
And a sushi roll.
Come in, I'll get you something to eat.
Hopefully he's passed all the health inspections as well.
That's right.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks, guys, for the first podcast of 2019. And thank you for our listeners for tuning in. And we'll speak to you all again next week.
Great to be back.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to this week's episode of The Investor Exchange. To access this episode's show notes, go to theinvestorexchange.com.au and follow us on Facebook at The Investor Exchange for updates on our latest episodes. This show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Before making any investment decision, contact United Global Capital by emailing ugc.net.au for a personalised, no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Or alternatively, email us at info@ugc.net.au.